Hello, you're listening to the This Is The Way Phase 4 podcast, and I'm your host, Steve Lisgauser. Marvel's Phase 4 continues on Disney Plus with Moon Knight, and Episode 1 of Season 1 is available as of March 30th, 2022. Additional episodes will become available each Wednesday until the Season 1 finale, which lines up with Star Wars Day of all things, May the 4th. We say before each podcast, but if you're listening to us, you should assume that anything officially released by Marvel is fair game for our discussion. We do not set out to spoil, but we do speculate. If there's a movie or show you haven't watched yet, please come back later. You have been warned.
Final warning.
Now that you've been warned, I want to address some comments by executive producer Grant Curtis that seem to imply the series will not be attached to the MCU. The way he explained it was that Mark Spector and this show were going to be treated from a development standpoint like Tony Stark and the movie Iron Man. I think that's pretty audacious. I don't think Marvel had any idea how well Jon Favreau's vision was going to set the stage for the years of movies that came after Iron Man. I do think it's important to mention his comments, though, because this is not going to be the next issue of the Avengers comic book series. Nor will it be episode one of a new volume. This is going to be part of the universe, just not in the way we usually expect it to be. I think what Curtis is explaining is more akin to creative freedom in creating this story and being able to manage expectations. We are in the multiverse, version of Marvel now. From what I've been seeing leak out, we're going to have to manage our expectations moving forward. We're very much interested in what happens in Phase 4 in Marvel. I mean, you did catch our podcast title, right? Now, this show may not tie in directly, and for all we know, it may never tie in beyond the characters that we might see. That also might just be Marvel smoke and mirrors. We are going to cover this show, though. I mean, you're here for this episode, right? I will reserve the right, though, to pull the plug or stop covering shows in the future, especially if Disney continues down their political path here in Florida. I'm not going to say any more on that matter at the moment, but if you'd like to tell me how you feel, please send emails to thisisthewayphase4@gmail.com or interact with us on Instagram or Twitter at thewayphase4. You can also check out our webpage at facebook.com/thewayphase4. I've also started using Linktree, so you can find us that way by going to linktr.ee/thewayphase4. We don't have to agree to have a fun discussion. All I'm looking for is respect, and I will give it freely. All right, about the episode. Episode 1 is called The Goldfish Problem. An article in Psychology Today that was just last month by Dr. Glenn Geher describes a goldfish in a fishbowl on a child's desk. It lives its life there, in the bowl, and to it, there's nothing outside that room, and life is contained in that fishbowl. What happens when things start getting moved around and the perception changes for that goldfish? Well, I think that's a nice, maybe secondary meaning, because of course we see Stephen Grant's goldfish dying in this episode and then being replaced by Mark Spector, and though it's played for comedy, it does illustrate how to that point great effort has been made to keep the Stephen part of the dissociative identity disorder separate from the Earth, the other personalities, like kind of like a fish in a fishbowl. Let's keep him in this area and no further, so he doesn't leak out. The episode has a Disney Plus stated runtime of 47 minutes. From just after the Disney Plus splash to the start of the end credits is about 41 minutes, 8 seconds, so you only need about 41 minutes to watch the show. The episode descriptions are very different for this show in the long and short forms. For example, the short description on the episodes tab on Disney Plus says, Stephen Grant learns that he may be a superhero, but may also share a body with a ruthless mercenary. The longer description that accompanies the episode, if you head back to the show page, says Stephen Grant, a mild-mannered man who works a mundane job, begins to suspect that his life may not be his own when an alter living inside of him begins to emerge. Alter is spelled A-L-T-E-R, not A-L-T-A-R, but I think it's poorly worded. I know what they mean. I know this is how an identity is described when someone's suffering from dissociative identity disorder, and this is Disney feeling proud of themselves for normalizing terminology. The director for episode one is Mohamed Diab, and Jeremy Slater is listed as the writer, and he is also the showrunner. Wikipedia lists all the directors and writers and the release dates for all six episodes. Now, we'll have to see if those match up correctly, but for now, I think we should get to the events of the first episode in order to see what kind of a show we're dealing with. The show starts with someone taking a drink of water in a glass, then they cover the glass with a towel and smash it. Then the person pours that into shoes and puts them on. I thought of the kinds of self-harm that some monks and maybe some zealots do to themselves. I'm thinking of like the self-flagellation of the guy in, not Angels and Demons, in the Da Vinci Code. I read this scene was an idea from Ethan Hawke, who plays Arthur Harrow, and who we later find out is the man who is doing this. And it's an interesting choice to start the show. This is maybe the only part that seems to fit from the comic version of Harrow. That's a guy who experimented on Jews in concentration camps for pain theory. So he's causing himself pain here, maybe trying to resist it. Seems to fit the comic character version, but this TV version does not appear to be, at the outset at least, a neo-Nazi. Every Grain of Sand, performed by Bob Dylan, is the song playing over this. And I think that's a song that he wrote after his conversion to Christianity or his being born again. Now, Harrow is walking away from the camera into a ruined temple, it seems. The scene fades to black, the music fades, and then some pop music begins to play. 60s pop music, according to the closed captioning. It's Engelbert Humperdinck performing A Man Without Love, and the Marvel Studios slate appears. Now, it's almost a tradition now where the first episode sets the tone without the Marvel fanfare. They pick a song and have it playing just like this. Now, if I had to guess, though, based on past shows, at least their second episodes, we're going to see next week the Disney Plus Splash return with a previously on segment, and then the Marvel Studios slate with the Marvel fanfare, and then the episode will begin.
Moonlight to show the way so we can follow.
From that song, A Man Without Love, the line from the song is trailing off, moonlight to show the way so we can follow. And then it fades to Stephen Grant waking up in his bed. And he's chained himself to it and poured sand around it. He tapes his door shut. It seems like he's trying to keep track of his whereabouts when he goes to sleep. He knows something's wrong and he's kind of in denial. He knows because this behavior is normal to him. He doesn't wake up in a shock. He's almost more shocked that he's just waking up and sitting there. He feeds his fish Gus, seems to be leaving a voicemail to his mother. I don't think he is. And he's talking about putting a postcard on Gus's fish tank. Now, I'm speculating he's not leaving voicemails to his mom, and that this is some sort of a way that Mark or another identity is keeping track of what Steven is doing. So the voicemail is an outbound update to some other identities. And the postcards are then the inbound ones. Now, he may not be aware or conscious of it. And I'm surprised a fish with one small fin isn't straight up named Nemo. I mean, Gus is a shark in that film, Finding Nemo. But Stephen Grant clearly knows pop culture, right? He calls it Gus for some reason. He later references the movie Avatar and the Avatar anime. So he knows pop culture. I don't know why this fish is Gus unless that's straight from the comics. Gus's tank has a pyramid, an Egyptian longboat, an obelisk, perhaps a bust of Nefertiti, but at least it's a head wearing a cap crown, and then what appears to be a tower or a temple. A lot of Egyptian Book of the Dead kind of stuff. Steven stays on the phone for a while he's getting ready. In fact, he leaves his apartment, and he's telling Mom that he feels like he got hit by a bus every morning he wakes up. He's on his way out the door and to work, apparently. He ends his calls to his mom with laters, gators, and I'm not sure of the significance, but the god Ammit is depicted as having the head of an alligator of the Nile. So that is curious to me. Maybe that's almost like a keyword for him. Humperdinck, still playing when he rides the bus. He's struggling to stay awake on his commute, but a man without love is still playing. And finally, he steps into a puddle in front of the museum, and it's a mirror image. It's nice symbolism. Very good choices in camera to show this dissociative identity disorder in a visual way for us. He walks in, Stephen does. He has a discussion with a young girl. We see he's educated on the Egyptian exhibits, and he kind of cares about upkeep of those exhibits. But it's not long before Donna, his boss, chastises him, tells him there's no way he'll be a tour guide.
I don't know how many times I have to tell you this. You're not the bloody tour guide, Stevie.
Stephen, actually, I am Stephen.
No, you're bloody useless.
Now, we don't get the motivation for Stephen working at the museum here explicitly, but knowing what we know about this show, I have a strong feeling that he's either been placed there, you know, by an altar or Khonshu, to be close to this Egyptian stuff. We find out that Stephen is, well, he's kind of a dork. He's not dumb, you know, but he's socially awkward. We know why he's socially awkward, because of this DID, but to Donna, he's really not an impressive guy. It surprises her and Stevie, as she calls him, that one of the tour guides, Dylan, has agreed to go on a date with him. They'll go for steak, apparently, even though either Stephen or her is vegan. And I believe in the comics, I guess that the Stephen altar is vegan.
Yeah, I can see why she went for it. Real catch you are.
He and Donna are in the storeroom then, doing inventory, apparently, and she'll later tell him that because he's late, he's going to be on that duty again by himself later in the week. Or next week, I guess. This is another moment for us to hear how Stephen seems to be more educated than at least the marketing department is for the museum, because he mentions to Donna that the Ennead is depicted with only 7 gods on a poster when there are 9. Khonshu and Ammit are not officially among those 9, at least in our real universe. Those are Atum, Shu, Tefnut, Geb, Nut, Nephthys, and then the ones that I knew without even looking up, Osiris, Isis, Set, and Horus. Those ones I can recall very easily. I wouldn't say they're the most famous of the gods, but I think they're pretty well known. Donna tells him that he still won't get a tour guide position despite all of his knowledge, and then tells him to leave. Now, Stephen passes actor Alexander Cobb, who is basically a poor man's Dax Shepard. I thought it might have been him, in fact. Cobb is playing security guard JB, and we see again, despite working there for however long and having even that passing work association, Stephen is so insignificant that the guard he sees somewhat regularly calls him Scotty.
Scotty n'est pas!
Stephen heads outside to a tourist spot. He's sitting and talking to a painted statue performer listed in the credits as Crawley, and I think we're just understand, at least, that this is the MCU version of Bertrand Crawley, a street informer for the Mark Spector identity. Here, it's the Stephen Grant alter ego talking to him about his problems, about how he's trying to keep track of what he's doing, when he suffers from a break. He mentions how the guy definitely gets in his 10,000 steps, and how he can't remember agreeing to a date, and even if he does, he can't take her back to his apartment with ankle straps on the bed. Grant does help Crawley by both taking a picture for a couple on a date with him in it, but also he reminds that couple to tip Crawley for the picture. So he's not just a bother here. He is actually performing a service for the guy.
Oh, don't forget the tip. Oh, yes.
He finishes his meal, says goodbye. The camera pans up from a shot of the puddle where there's a half-moon-shaped light from an awning, I guess, above Crawley and Grant in the image. And then there's a leaf that falls into the water, breaking up the mirrored image, sending ripples out from the puddle. Just great camera work again. Then Grant is back in his flat, pouring sand to cover his tracks. We see him going through a routine to secure himself and then keep himself awake. He's listening to a Staying Awake program.
Hello, and welcome to Staying Awake.
He's doing things like reading, playing with a Rubik's Cube because he doesn't want to fall asleep and lose control. And then, all right, so I'm that guy. He read a passage on the Ennead, and I looked it up. It's from Tristan A.A. Forshaw, from what I could see from chapter 3, page 51, of the book Ancient Egypt. It looks like an old book. And the text from this book is actually seen in the two other books that Stephen seems to be studying as well from the staying awake reading portion of his night. Yeah, I Googled it. I looked up the book on academia.edu, and it appears to be ancient Egypt. I don't know exactly when it was printed or anything, but the writing seems to match up. Stephen keeps studying, keeps doing puzzles, keeps reading, trying to stay awake, but...
Go back to sleep, worm.
Hello?
He can't. He wakes in a field. It's in Germany or maybe Switzerland. He has no recollection of how he got there. Suddenly he hears a voice telling him to go back to sleep and surrender the body to Mark. I thought at first, and maybe you did too, that it was Liam Neeson, unless you knew that the voice belongs to F. Murray Abraham. He turns around, Stephen does. We expect him to see the mummified-looking figure that's behind him, but he doesn't. There's nothing there. Instead, he looks upward and sees a broken window in a castle, and someone's looking down at him. Now, apparently, either Moon Knight or Mark Spector or some other identity leapt from the window with an engraved golden scarab. That's an impossible fall for a human to survive, but there's something supernatural going on, and we understand that. The man above is actually a henchman for Harrow, and we'll find that out. He and others start shooting at him, and that drives Grant to run into a nearby town, and unfortunately, there are not just many more henchmen there. It seems like the townsfolk are also followers of Harrow. Harrow is performing judgments for Ammit, an Egyptian deity and eater of the dead, who in reality, in our world, it was just the executioner of the dead for Anubis. Ammit sat next to the scales of judgment, not presiding over them, but in this show, Harrow describes Ammit as being the judge and growing impatient while judging the dead only. Harrow is here, though, judging the living. In fact, he judges one of his followers to be pure of heart. But then another, an old woman, he judges it sometime in the future is going to fail, and she dies there, right in the street. Harrow learns from a henchman that an exchange went bad and some of his men were killed in an ambush, so he tricks Stephen Grant by commanding his followers to kneel in reverence. Harrow seems to recognize him as a mercenary. Grant spills all the beans and Harrow demands the return of the scarab. Grant agrees, but his body will not let him. It's played for comedy. He keeps trying to hand it over, but his body just won't let it. His hand's closed. His hand moves behind him. It goes on for a little too long. The henchmen, they decide they're going to drag him away, and then a shopkeeper runs out from his store to liberate the scarab from Stephen's hand. Stephen, though, has his first break that we witness. We do not see what happened. We only see the aftermath and shocked people. Stephen's bloodied hand holding the scarab once again, and there are several bodies on the ground.
No, the idiot's back.
The voice in his head, Khonshu, laments that the idiot is back. Grant commandeers a cupcake truck and drives off. Wham! Is playing on the stereo. It is not long before the henchmen catch up to him, and there's a pretty good action sequence here on the mountainside road. Stephen Grant loses control at just the right moments to Mark, or whoever it is. So that saves the body that he's in, and I think the way that the brakes that he has ends up being very effective. So the last time he loses control in Switzerland or Germany, he wakes back up then in his apartment. It seems as if Stephen thinks this is all a bad dream. Engelbert is once again playing, so we are left to wonder, is this really a dream? If we didn't know so much about Moon Knight, we might think it might be. If Stephen went missing, though, and Mark took over and got home, I would have thought that Mark would have attended the date with a tour guide, or if he was late to that, he would have attempted to call her if he's the one who set it up. I mean, why did he set up the date if he didn't plan on going out with her, right? We learn it's Sunday, not Friday, so it's possible if he wakes up late on a Sunday that he only just now got to bed and wakes up after a long weekend of country hopping, but maybe he was gone 3 days from Thursday night to Sunday, but then the pet shop girl says he was there yesterday. Maybe it's just that Mark doesn't care that much at all about Stephen. Stephen notices Gus now has two fins. So it isn't Gus. And he goes back to the pet store and he hears that he was there yesterday. He notices the clock, thinks he has to get to his date. Quick trip home, dressing himself, looks at himself in the mirror with three angles. It's a nice touch again on the set that plays off the three personalities, that three-way mirror or the mirror with three sides to it. Then Steven goes to wait at the restaurant for a girl who will not come because she came already. He calls Dylan only to learn that he stood her up on Friday and she is not pleased, tells him, lose my number. Steven gets despondent over what he keeps learning about this other self. Now, it's much more interesting for us to learn about this character this way, from the weaker version of him, than it would be to see the stronger mercenary losing control to a weakling. So I am happy with what we're seeing so far. I think this is an effective storytelling technique. Steven resorts to eating chocolate, feeding his new Gus sugary sprinkles, and then he drops his chocolate bonbons on the floor, but notices when he's picking them up, scratches. There's an out-of-place table. He drags the table over, looks up, sees a dislodged wood panel, climbs up, reaches into the opening, discovers a key and a flip phone. Someone named Layla has been calling quite often, as well as an entry for a Duchamp, which is a character from the comics as well, and I guess we're going to learn about him, or maybe we don't, in later episodes. Maybe that's just an Easter egg. Steven calls back Layla.
Actually, as he's about to call her, she calls him.
She calls him Mark and is wondering about his put-on accent, and then he hangs up on her, or she hangs up on him, and then the lights begin to flicker, and he ends up coming face-to-face with himself in his bathroom mirror. It's his alter ego, Mark, telling him to stop looking. I guess stop trying to figure this out. Like, we've set this thing up here. So you're in this fishbowl that we put you in on purpose, right? And I suppose it's a refuge. Maybe a bit of normalcy away from his superhero persona. Steven is deathly frightened here. But for the life of me, I can't figure out how this is more frightening than what he thought he was experiencing when he was awake in the Swiss Alps. He didn't think it was a dream in that moment and didn't quite freak out as much as he seems to be here. So how is he so frightened now? And more frightened seeing this than when he heard Khonshu for what he thinks is the first time, I guess. Whatever the reasoning, he flees to the elevator and we get to see the scene from the trailer with the old woman and the mention of contact lenses. There's more camera play with mirrors until Steven turns around and comes face to face with Khonshu. Steven must have dissociated again. He wakes this time standing on a bus. He sees Khonshu on the road from the bus. He gets out of the bus, looks back inside, and I guess Arthur must have been on the top level, then came down, because he wasn't in the previous scene at all on the bus. But Steven realized that the man from his dream is real. He's apparently on his way to work, I guess based on his clothes. That must be the only way that he knows that. Mark and Khonshu seem mostly annoyed when Steven takes control, but they also seem to want to keep him content. Steven appeals to security guard JB for helping to keep strange people out of the museum, but what Steven expects him to do is beyond me here. I mean, JB even points that out. It's a free museum. Maybe if you're afraid, don't go to work. Donna comes up, joins in the teasing, but somehow Steven remembers the guy standing in front of Harrow on the bus and follows him. Why they didn't just have it be Harrow walking in, I don't understand, because I had to go back and check frame by frame for this large guy with a bald spot on the bus. I'm like, why is he following that guy?
Oh my God, that man was on the bus.
I don't give a monkey's. Take this downstairs.
Will you please just give me a minute, yeah? Thanks, Donna.
Steven follows him and ends up finding out that there are actually several people in cahoots with Arthur in the museum. One of them actually even a security guard there. I think that was a poor choice. It brings up questions about the reach of this organization. But nevertheless, Harrow monologues about Amit for us, the audience. Steven responds back, pointing out about Arthur's take on Amit being not one from the history books, which I believe that I already pointed out. He then sneakily, though, has Amit judge Steven by holding his hands, and then the scales tattoo on his arm do the thing that they did in Switzerland, but they don't render a final judgment. Instead, Harold lets him go because there's too much chaos in him to keep the scales going. So Steven apparently stays at work, does inventory when he hears howling. And I'll point out, Anubis, the god of the dead, has a dog head or a jackal's head. So Anubis is actually the judge of the afterlife in reality. But here it appears Marvel might not, maybe they're not changing things up. Maybe they're actually having Amit supplant Anubis. Maybe that's what Khonshu is doing, trying to prevent Amit from upsetting the dynamics of the Egyptian Ennead. So Steven goes looking for the noises, then he goes on a run from the monster, and he's hiding. Arthur comes over the PA, says, I want the scarab.
Steven Grant of the gift shop, give me the scarab, and you won't be torn apart.
I don't think Steven has it in his pocket, so even if he wanted to, I don't know how he's supposed to get it to Arthur without dying. He runs into a bathroom, down a hallway to hide, just in time. And then the mirrors are played to great effect here once again. Mark makes a clear appeal to Steven from the mirror. He wants him to let him take over. It's the only way to save them, he says. Hieroglyphs seem to flicker on the walls of the bathroom. Mark continues to ask for control. Steven appears to give in. And his head goes back and he begins to be enveloped by wrappings, and the beast beats its way into the bathroom and it pounces on him. The scene shifts to the hallway outside the bathroom. We hear sounds of a struggle and a wash basin gets thrown out. But it's not Steven struggling to get away, it's the monster. Steven is beating the monster with his bare hands, only it's not Steven. It's Moon Knight. That's where the episode leaves off, and that's probably where we will pick up next week. What'd you think? Now, I didn't see evidence of Moon Knight being Marvel's answer to Batman here in this episode, but I do think the way they've chosen to represent the changes between Mark and his personality is pretty clever. Now, it's not like Bruce Banner, and there's not a line that stands out after one of the episodes like Bruce's secret being that he's always angry. You know, it's just a sound effect and some flickering. It's effective, though. We get a hint of a mystery. We get a character being revealed in an interesting way. I think having Ethan Hawke and Oscar Isaac against each other is good for the show. I think that's a formula that's working for Marvel. You cast good actors in the main roles, and that lends credibility to the stories that you tell. I'm a little concerned with the cult aspect. It seems a little weird to me. I'm a little concerned that this is not directly tied into the MCU, but based on what happened in Spider-Man No Way Home and Loki and What If, I think you can make a case that everything is now tied in because there are infinite multiverses. That can be a slippery slope for writers and for intellectual properties. I don't think you want to keep hearing the differences between realities explained as different universes in the multiverse. You know, that you want to have some continuity, I think. But we have 5 more episodes of Moon Knight to see where they take it, and then there's a month or so until Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness hopefully reveals much, much more about Marvel's plans for Phase 4. I'll be back again next week for coverage of Episode 2 after it becomes available on April 6th. I don't yet have the title, but it seems that it'll be written by Michael Castelline. I believe he also worked on The Falcon and the Winter Soldier series. Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead are directing. If you want to comment about coverage, or something you think I should have mentioned that I chose to skip, please check out our links on Linktree at linktr.ee/thewayphase4. The best way to connect with me, though, is to email. thisisthewayphase4@gmail.com. This has been This is the Way Phase 4's Season 1, Episode 1 discussion of Moon Knight. I'm Steve Lascalzo. Until next time, friends.